Welcome to the Strange Motion Way podcast. I am Tim Strange, along with my hostess with the mostest,
Carrie Strange.
We're going to be bringing you a lot of interviews with custom people, hot rodders, street rodders, some drag racers. Yes, we're going to include some BMX and
cats.
Our other co-hosts are Turbo and Axel.
All right, Tim, let's get it started. The Strange Motion Way podcast, brought to you by Royal Purple Synthetic Oils.
Royal Purple premium synthetic motor oils and high-performance chemicals have been designed to improve performance in all conditions and provide cleaner operation, better mileage, and decreased oil change frequency. That means less oil changes. With products available for your gasoline and diesel engines, Royal Purple is the obvious choice for your performance needs. Drive with Royal Purple, the synthetic expert.
Okay, so after the Predicta, kind of in the hot rod world, custom car world, your household name, kind of, after the Predicta, right, really.
Skyrocketed.
Yeah, so after the Predicta, what do you do? What's your next project after the Predicta?
Called the Forecaster. Forecaster was built up around a Corvair.
That's the one that was missing and is getting re-debuted this weekend. Is that the Forecaster?
The Forecaster, the clone was built this past year.
And is debuting, Everett's building it and bringing it to the show.
It's a Futurista.
Okay, the Forecaster was the one that was there last year, the pink one. Okay.
Or two.
Yeah, two last years year. Ago, maybe. Yeah. Okay.
Or 2 years ago.
Okay, another big bubble top car.
Yeah.
And
Futurista was the third one.
Okay.
And it was a three-wheel car.
So, okay, we're going to jump around a little bit there. We're going to, you took a car out to California, and you didn't, what was that event? And you didn't win that one, and then you bought the show.
Oh, that was the Futurista.
Okay.
What the deal was on the Futurista, that's a good story. Al Sloniker, I'd already won with the Predicta, of course, and the Corvair both. And I went to Al Sloniker come after I built the Forecaster, the second bubble top. The third bubble top was actually a 58 Chevy, which I built for Playboy in New Orleans. That was that 58 Chevy bubble top Cobra.
You built it for who?
A Playboy hairdresser.
Oh, okay.
In New Orleans. Huh. He used to have a New Orleans Playboy club.
Okay.
And he actually brought it up and his car up and I made a bubble top out. But I had already, he actually bought the car, a guy named Harvey, that I built it. And it was a Chop 58 Chevy, period. All I did for the next guy was put a bubble top on it. But the body had already been done.
Okay.
And even in a magazine, but it had a chopped top. But I took the chopped top off for this new owner, which was a Playboy, a hairdresser, not a Playboy. And he got it. J.P. Daniels was his name. And he come pick the car up, and he gave me half of it, and he brought it, which I always make him do. Before it even started, you know, and he gave me half the money. Well, he come back to get it, and he says, "Darrell, I'll send you the money." And I said, "You what?" And he says, "Yeah, I'll send you the money in a few days. Don't worry about it." I said, "I'm not going to worry about it because the car doesn't go nowhere until the money comes here."
Yeah.
So several weeks go by, and I'm thinking, the guy ain't got no money. So he shows back up. And he says, "Come on now, let me have my car. I've got it booked enough. I can pay you." And I said, "Well, that's great. But in the meantime, I filed a mechanics lien against it, which I had." And 90 days is my car anyway. You know how that works, mechanics lien. And I said, "You got 45 days left, and it's my car anyway. I don't even have to buy it or nothing. But I want money. I don't really want the car." So he goes to a car dealer in Wichita and sells the car in my shop to this car dealer. Well, then the car dealer wants the car because he sold it to another guy in St. Louis, all out of pictures. Well, the guy's come with a carrier, a flatbed trailer, to take it to St. Louis because this guy bought it from J.P. Daniels. So Daniels got his money, paid me off. The car went to St. Louis. On the way to St. Louis, believe it or not, they put that thing upside down in the ditch, busted the bubble, and tore his car up pretty good. And it sat in that shop for probably 25 years, covered up in it. He also had an airplane. He had a hangar. He put that little car all wrecked in the back of that hangar, and it sat there covered up for almost 20 years or so. Nobody even knew where it was. I didn't even know where it was because I just lost count of it. But it was there all that time. But anyway, that's what happened to that car. And that car was not even the futuristic yet. It was a 58 T-Bird. I built that for Dick Scully, which is out of Chicago. And Dave Poole worked for me, went to work for me right after. He had a shop there called, in Chicago, Trend Custom. Him and another guy were partners. And I went to a show in Chicago and met Dave and told him, man, I'd give anything if you'd come to work for me. And he did.
How long did he work for you?
3 years or four. And he built quite a few cars, actually. He went back to Chicago and started his own shop. That's when it burned down and burned up several cars, real high-dollar cars. He ended up working for the mafia to pay it off because one of them was owned by the...
Allegedly. It's probably, what is it, when something's been long enough, you can't get somebody in trouble? You always have to say allegedly, so you don't want to get somebody in trouble.
Okay, then I should
That's what I always joke about.
Well,
what do they call that when it's been over 7 years? It's...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Many years
ago. Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, you're right, though. I got to be careful saying that.
Yeah.
After me, they might be anyway. To make that long story end, and I really even should say this, I guess. He dies, Dave Poole, mysteriously. They moved him to us, anyway, he wanted to get out of doing what he did for the mob or for the illegal people, whoever they are. He collected money on baseball betting and football betting. He's the guy that went out to the place and picked the money up for. And this is in the 80s or whatever it was. And so, anyway, he picked up money for him, and then they billed him. He wanted to quit. He'd come back and wanted to go back to work for me. Well, when he went back and told them he's going to come to work for me, they wouldn't let him out, you know, because he knew too much.
Yeah.
Well, in essence. And so they billed him a restaurant, or a bar, I mean, bar, restaurant, sports bar, whatever you want to call it, in
Chicago area.
Somewhere. Fort Worth, maybe. One of the bigger cities down that direction. I can't think
of. Texas?
What?
You said Fort Worth, Texas?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So he's not in Chicago anymore?
No, not in Chicago.
Okay.
It was Arizona. Phoenix, or right outside of Phoenix. Can't think of the name of that darn thing. Anyway, they built, and it's called Old Chicago Bar. Old Chicago Bar. He ran that for, gosh, I don't know, 10 years, probably, maybe longer. Well, next thing I hear, he dies. And because he'd come back to me and wanted to get the job back, and I said, I'd be glad to have you back. Well, they wouldn't let him take the job. And they put that Old Chicago Bar in, they shipped him to Old Chicago. And he ran that for years. Well, at the end, they come back to me one more time. Just shortly before he died, he said he wanted to get out of the Old Chicago. Well, then he dies. He wasn't that old there. But anyway, I don't know what happened to him exactly. But his wife, on the other hand, donated the one car he had left that he had built, which was called it was a project car for Rod and Custom Magazine. What was that called? Well, anyway, it's a famous car. they did a whole story on
the car. The little short car, is that one like Mark Moriarty has it? Or has a clone of that?
No, this is that long one. I've still got it. But his wife gave it back to me.
Okay.
And I restored the whole thing back to it. And it's in
Speedway?
Speedway.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's there right now.
Okay, I can't think of the name. I can see the car.
Low streamline.
Yeah.
It was American Motors gave the engine and all the mechanics to it. At that time, yeah. To Dave Poole. And Spencer Murray had just retired from Rod and Custom, Spencer Red. Mm-hmm. And Spencer went to his shop and helped him build that car.
So there was a lot of, you built cars in the magazines, there was a lot of company support of getting motors and drivetrain. And I've been lucky with that through the years, too. We've got motors from GM and Ford and Ford Motorsports. And that kind of has went away.
Yes, pretty much.
Yeah, it's hard there's now. Still some, you know, we've got a dozen vehicles gave to us from, you know, the orange truck was given to me from GM to build for SEMA. And that's just a different program. They don't really continue with that with the customizers anymore. We kind of wish they did. So,
well, they gave Cliff the brand new Mustang to build a monster truck out. But it was a track test car. Mm-hmm. They could never put on the highway.
Yeah.
Had to be made in a monster truck. Their big problem with their car giveaway was liability.
Yeah, yeah.
They were responsible if you ever drove the thing on the highway and killed somebody.
Yeah. So kind of jumping ahead, there was some cars I wanted to touch about. You know, there's a thing now that people, they do chassis swaps and stuff, and they take newer cars and skin them with old bodies. But you were one of the first guys that did the Crystal Ball Merc. You did, it was the 80s you did that car, right?
Right.
And that was a steel Mercury. And what did you put for the drivetrain on that?
A LeBaron.
Okay.
Chrysler.
And you used the dash and all the electronics. And you did quite a few of the, what I call the chassis swap vehicles through the years with Lincolns. That probably when you did that Crystal Ball Merc, I remember that in the magazines. Okay. That was almost, I mean, there was people doing stuff, but that was kind of unheard of to use all the electronics and all that stuff at that time. So another thing you were kind of first at was the chassis swap stuff.
And that was the first. That was actually the second section Mercury in the world. The first section Mercury I did myself 10 years before that, the very first chopped and sectioned Mercury. Mm-hmm. And it was also before the Crystal Ball Merc. And that was in, nobody even sectioned. That was the first section Mercury ever. And it was in all the magazines, too. Mm-hmm. That was long before the bubble top car. So
we've got sidetracked a couple times, but you did the car and you took it out to the car show and didn't win.
Oh yeah.
Let's do that story.
That's a good story too. Well, not a good story for me, but a good story. I took the car out there because at the year before I won the Oakland show won Car of the Future, which I never ever won nothing because I just, everywhere I went, they'd make up something to give me that was over and above everybody else, but it still was just made up name. It didn't mean nothing because I didn't win it from anybody. I was the only one in it, even though I'd be considered the top car and award. But anyway, in 1963, Al Slonick, which was promoter of the show from the very beginning, he says, I want to put a new effect this year called the Tournament of Fame.
Tournament of Fame.
Tournament of Fame. And the Tournament of Fame, to win it, you've got to have the most creative car. And he listed a whole bunch of things the car had to be first time shown. And he only invited six guys to participate in it, six top builders. Mm-hmm. Which was Bill Cushenberry, George Burris, Balon, myself, There's six of them anyway. Another one. Oh, Willow. Mm-hmm. And Barrett's Court. And so anyway, we left her with that instruction. This is what has to be the winner. And the guy at Wendy is going to get a free trip to Paris with his wife and spend 2 weeks, all expenses paid.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Bonogram and I said, I don't want to win that thing, to the president of the company at that time. And he says, whatever it takes, win it. I don't care what it is. We're going to make a model. The same time you're making the car, I'm going to be building the model. You just keep me pictures mm-hmm. so I can build the car. And we're going to introduce that car to show you win it. Because the way you got it laid out, and it's according to instructions, you're the only car there that's going to qualify in every one of these areas and win everyone. I got a build a car like that. The most futuristic, most mm-hmm. best designed, best built, best engineered, you name it. Everything that nobody had ever done, basically. And it even has remote control, which had never been done in that text, because it says, I'm the futurist, so I can turn my front wheel. It would turn the front wheel. It did 7 or 8 different actions. Opened the top, started the engine, raised the doors up and down, turned the front wheel, started the engine. Did all these actions. Took about 30 minutes. Every hour, there's an hour off and an hour on of doing that, and an hour or 30 minutes off, 30 on, 30 off. And the show was 10 days, five. One weekend, open at 6 o'clock all through the week.
10-day show.
10-day show.
Wow.
And that little car, believe it or not, performed every one of those things without ever failing. Every one of them. And not one time was there anybody close to the car. Nobody, period. The car itself just looked like it's sitting there talking. Nobody could figure it out because there was nobody around. Mm-hmm. Everybody looking around for somebody with remote control. You know, like airplane control. Mm-hmm. Well, nobody ever could figure out how an old bike could work. Well, I'll tell you how it worked. I used a wall and sack tape recorder. Okay. And a wall and sack tape recorder, I put a little piece of aluminum every time I wanted to change something on the tape.
Mm-hmm.
When that come to that little tape, I took a jukebox, took all the parts out of the jukebox and made that little tape. When it come to that little tape, it hit a valve or set the wire off,
mm-hmm.
electricity, that opened the valve that made one of them things work.
Mm-hmm.
All off the tape recorder.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody around, period. And it ran 30 minutes. Well, to say the least, we spent a lot of time making that thing work right. But for that many days, 10 days, and every show I went to after that, that car never failed that part of it. Unbelievable. That little, and it was a Volkswagen engine sitting in the back, and I laid it down so the fan ran on top of the engine instead of standing up, because
mm-hmm.
I wanted it real low profile. I also made it didn't have an automatic transmission, and I had stick steering in it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so I had to build a, they didn't make an automatic transmission for a Volkswagen, but I had to have a push button automatic.
Mm-hmm.
I actually converted that automatic or that 4-speed automatic to an automatic with valves and solenoids. And the way you'd make it shift is hit a button and it would shift into the next gear. Well, to do that, it didn't have a clutch. So you had to have the clutch work automatically along with the. I did also all remotely or not remotely, but mechanically with valves, hydraulic. That took, God, I don't know, I'd hate to think how many hours that took. But I did at least have a guy helping me on that was pretty sharp on hydraulic. He actually ran a starter, that rebuilt starters,
mm-hmm.
and he was pretty sharp on that, so pretty sharp on He's crippled though, and he's an older guy. But I learned a lot from him, and he learned a lot from me. I mean, back and forth, we managed to make it through it all. And we did it all with pinball machines, and because there's no computers in them days.
You know? Yeah.
Anyway, it could be done, and it was done easily just this last weekend, because this circuit, or presenting the Futurista again, doing all those things.
Oh, cool.
So you're going to see it happen again. Yeah,
very cool.
But it's all done with computers now, not all them complicated things I had to do it with.
You had all this stuff in that car,
yeah,
and ended up not winning the award, did it?
And then I did all this. I followed all the rules first time shown, and it won in every one of the categories, way above everybody. So on the Saturday night before the show ended, Saturday night, all the Hall of Fame members, we always had a party. Anybody wanted the Hall of Fame in Oakland. And I was one of them. The only problem was I was the only one out of California. The rest of them all were in California. Well, it was two of us. One guy out of Portland. Him and I were the only two in the whole show that were in the Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the only one out of California. He was the only one out, but he was in Portland. His car wouldn't qualified for getting run in the show. But anyway, Al Sonner gets up, he says, after we all eat and everything, he says, now the judges can't decide who should win a trip to Paris. I thought, how in the world can that happen? You know, and he says, what we're going to do, because we can't, the judges won't pick the car. They just say, we just can't do that. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to have you guys vote on it right now. The Hall of Fame guys. I turned it on and I said, we just lost. She says, how could we lose?
You're not California crew.
Every car there was from California except Bison.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, Bill Cushenberry, and to make it even worse, had shown the year before, which is completely against the rules.
Yeah.
But he still gave it to him. And he won it. And I got up when it was over. I couldn't find Sloaner. He disappears. But I talked to several people. I said, I was upset, of course. I said, guess what? I'll buy this show. That'll never happen to anybody again. And I did.
Bought the show.
It took me 10 years later to buy it, though.
Yeah.
But I did buy it. And I made sure nobody ever won that show again that shouldn't win it.
Yeah. What year did you buy the Grand National Roadster show?
In 63.
And you owned it for how many years?
Oh, wait a minute. Let's do that again. You asked me how long I won what now? The Roadster Show?
When you bought the Grand National Roadster Show.
Oh, I bought it.
Oh, bought it when you bought it.
Oh, 72.
Okay, and how long did you own it?
92.
So you owned it for 20 years. You owned the Grand National Roadster Show.
Yeah, still close. Yeah. Maybe 19 years.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
Something like that. And I sold it. And I didn't really want to sell it. I don't know whether I should even tell this story, but it's actually a good, legitimate story. I went to my attorney after being partners with Bagdasarian, Bill Bagdasarian.
Because you told me, back up a little bit, we've spent a lot of time telling stories through the years, hanging out and stuff. And they finally let you buy it, but they made you have a California partner. Is that correct?
Exactly.
And that's how you got Bagdasarian, I always say his name right, Baggy, which was Sacramento.
He
did the Sacramento custom show, and they still call the Baggy Award there the Baggy Pick.
Yeah.
So that was he was your partner.
He was a partner. Plus, Bill Roach was my third partner.
Okay.
When we bought the original from Al Sonner, because I had no money, really. I had several shows going, 10 of them or something.
Who was Bill Roach? Where was he
Bill
from?
Bill Roach owned the
it wasn't the Roach. Roach t-shirt guy, that's a different...
No, no.
Okay.
Bill Roach owned rental car.
Oh, okay.
In Oakland. One of the big ones. Terrible. This is a senior moment, which I have occasionally now.
Yeah. We're doing good with all these years and dates, because I don't think I can remember what I ate for lunch yesterday right now. So
I can't either anymore. But anyway, he became my third partner.
Okay.
And I did that because, first of all, I couldn't come up with the rest of the money, because I didn't want Bank Assurance to have 50% of it. Mm-hmm. So he ended up with a third, and I ended up with a third. And the new Bill would always be on my side, because he didn't even know Bank Assurance. And I met Bill Roach. Bill Roach had showed his shows, but he wasn't a good friend or nothing. But Bill became a good friend of mine, which I didn't know him either, because he owned Budget Rent-A-Car, which is a big company, you know. Mm-hmm. But he liked me, and I liked him, and we got to be friends at the show itself for a couple of years. And so anyway, I took him in as a third partner. The first year he comes to me when it's over, I changed the Roadster show from making about $20,000 a year to make $100,000 the first year profit. I split the $33,000 between three of us. Mm-hmm. And Bill got $33,000 and didn't do nothing. Well, at least Baggy was there, and he accepted the entries as it came in into California. So he had done something, because I couldn't do all that. I was doing all these shows right up to the show, the day of the show started, or setting up. But anyway, he come to me when the show's over, and he said, "Darrell, I don't want part of the show no more. Everybody's hollering at me that didn't win." And he says, "I got no reason to have people hollering at me about a car show that I don't have nothing to do with, really, other than put money into." And he said, told them, "I don't have no control over it. I don't even control that part of it." But he said, "They're driving me crazy. Phones ringing. Everybody's wanting to know why they lost this, lost that," which they do, you know. So he says, "I want out, and I want you to buy me out." And I said, "That's fine. We'll do that. Don't worry about it. I'll buy you. Just, that's fine." Well, so I finally come up with the money to buy him out. I go to him, and I said, "Okay, I'm ready now to buy it." He says, Roach says, "I can't sell it to just you. I got to sell it equal to Baggy and you, because I don't want to be just, you know, favorable to you 100%. So anyway, all at once, I end up with a 50-50 partner, equal vote, Baggy, sir, and me. 18 years I was at, or however many years I owned it. I went to him, and I said, "Baggy, I want to buy you out. You know, I like you. I love you. And your family and everybody." But he says, "You and I just we're just not on the same page, and we never have been." He's always fighting to make Sacramento bigger than Oakland. That was his dream in life. Mm-hmm. You know? So he would do things opposite of making it work against, just so it would not be bigger known than Sacramento. So I said, "I got to be out." Plus, he sold all the commercial space, which in them days is $100,000 worth of commercial space. And I'd get half and he'd give it. The only problem was he didn't keep books on the commercial. You had to pay him cash. Mm-hmm. You had to have no record of buying, how much you bought.
Allegedly.
It was all just word of mouth. Uh-huh. And then when the show was over, he'd say, "Well, we brought in $80,000 this year. You got 40. You know, credit toward your part of it." And I said, "Well," and he did this the whole time we owned Oakland, 18 years. And I just took it, you know, whatever he said, I did it. About 2 years before that happened, ended, I had Jim Troyer, which worked for me at that time, that used to run ISCA, which I got him that job too, because he worked for me a lot of years, Jim did. I had him go around there and count every commercial booth and talk to the guys, and they would braggingly tell him how much they paid for it, most of them. Mm-hmm. And I had him keep track of all that, and it come up to a heck of a lot more money than bag he'd ever told me he sold. You know. So I didn't tell him this, but I said, you know, it's always been a problem. You guys selling the commercial space, and I'm not knowing where they're going or why or anything about it, and I'm too busy. I leave the day after the show to go do another show somewhere. And the day before, I just finished the show. So I don't have a lot of time to spend on this. And I said, I want to buy you out, so you don't have to worry about it. I don't have to worry about it. I can have my people do all that, not you. He says, and I went to a lawyer and told him all this. And he says, the only way you can get out of a partnership, period, completely out of it, with no agreement between you, is to make a bid to him for his part. And he's either got to match that bid, or, and he'll own it, you won't, or you're going to end up with the show, but you got to pay him whatever you bid. Well, I bid way above what I thought the show was worth. Son of a gun comes up with his half. Well, he's supposed to have done this on his own. He can't have a partner. So a guy named Tognotti, he owned the biggest speed shop in California.
Yep.
And Tognotti was his partner. Tognotti gave him past half the money, but no word to me, period. Baggy just come to me and handed him the money. You're out. Where in the world did you get that money? I mean, cash. Well, he wouldn't tell me. He said, that's all. I come up with the money. That's all I got to do. No, I got no partners. Okay.
So 20 years you were done running the Roadster show. So during this time, you were also running shows around the country.
Oh, definitely.
And
14 of them.
14 every year?
Yeah.
How many shows do you think you ran? What year did you start doing shows? And
59.
Technically still doing shows. The kids, it's the next generation, they're calling it, but they're still doing the Tulsa show.
The first show was 57.
57. Been running car shows since 1957. You've stepped out of running the Tulsa show. You had Oklahoma City and Wichita and got rid of them. And then so the Tulsa show still go. When did the kids start taking over the Tulsa show and called the next generation? It's been, what, 5-6 years? Has it been a little more than that?
Number 8.
8 years ago.
Okay. Ever since the 50s. This is 50.
Oh, okay. Okay. I knew that. I just forgot that. So yeah, you've been running car shows all over. One story you told me real quick, if we could, you got invited to go Mexico City.
Oh, yeah. Well, I went to Mexico City.
And you didn't run a show.
I did not run it, but I went there and met with the president, or the president of the Coliseum, or not Coliseum, but National Auditorium.
Yeah.
So I went there. I actually went down there to a producer's meeting in Acapulco. And on the way down there, I flew into Mexico City. And Don and I, she stayed in a motel, but I went in a taxi to the National Building and talked to the manager of the building. Well, much to my amazement, the management never spoke English. The manager of the National Auditorium. So I went back out in a taxi cab and got the guy that could speak English, was from Mexico.
The taxi driver.
A taxi driver. And he was my interpreter. He went back in with me, and he could speak English, and his secretary could speak English, but his secretary, she wouldn't be the interpreter. I mean, whatever you want to call them, between us. So anyway, I'm talking to him, and he's talking to my taxi cab driver. He says, well, that's fine. You know, what size building do you want? And I said, well, I want to put a minimum of 100 cars in here. And it looks like your auditorium might hold 50 without any trouble. Don't worry about it, Daryl. This is what he says. But in Spanish.
Yeah.
I'll build you a building. You go, what? You know, that's what I told the tag. I said, he says, what? He said, I'll build you a building outside here on the mall, which I do all the time for people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a portable, not a portable, mm-hmm. but a wooden building that we construct any size you want. And he says, we've done it many times over the years. So I said, well, what was that cost? And he said, well, he told me the cost. And he says, but there's one catch to it. You got to have a Mexican partner or we can't do that. The partner has to own 50% of it. I said, I got to have a Mexican partner. I don't even know anybody from Mexico. He says, well, there's a speed shop here in town. It's called, can't remember the exact name of it. Oh, yeah, Grand Prix Speed Shop, Grand Prix. And it's a pretty famous speed shop in Mexico. And they do a lot of business. He said, they'll be glad to be your partner. And I'll fix it for you. I'm thinking, God, I got a Mexican partner. And I've got to furnish the tickets. But on the other hand, they sell them. I don't even get to sell them. And all I get to do is hand them tickets and they can sell however many they want to and tell me however many they sold.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I take all this in and write it all, writing it all down. I'm trying to give to Donna to figure out what the heck, how to put a contract together that would hold in Mexico, and took it to my lawyer. Well, anyway, long story. The whole thing just fell apart because it just way over my head.
Mm-hmm.
I could have lost everything. Well, come to find out later, probably 6 months later, Evil Knievel went to Mexico with all of his bicycle, motorcycle, and his truck. They confiscated the whole thing, never got any of it back. Lost every penny of it. Did ever get his trucks or bikes back.
They confiscated not only all the money, but all of his equipment. So
all
that
of his equipment. Put it on hold.
Yeah.
So they wouldn't give him the money because they say he cheated them. Tell them how much.
So they might have done, allegedly, they might have done that to you too.
And I would have been in the same boat. I would have lost 100 cars.
Yeah.
Or could have. I would have probably come up with money. But
how many years did you were part of the ISCA too? Because not all your shows you ran were ISCA synced, but you did ISCA for quite a few years. You know, growing up, the 70s and 80s, there was ISCA shows and small indoor shows everywhere. Like Peoria, Illinois had one. And, you know, I posted a picture. I was probably 8-10 years old. And your grandson, Cody, said, oh, that's Grandpa's T behind you. You know, it was one of your cars on tour. But how many years were you involved in the ISCA as that organization itself?
See, I started. I went to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to Bob Larrabee's very first show that he actually owned. Bob mm-hmm.
Larrabee Sr.?
Yeah, Senior.
Okay.
Senior actually was president of the Michigan Hot Rod Association.
Okay.
That's what he was, president of the Bob Lurie. Well, when they had the older guys in the association wanted out, they wanted to sell the show.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Bob Lurie could only come up with part of the money. So he bought 25% of it. Or, I mean, he bought 75% on a payment plan.
Mm-hmm.
And 25% of it went to Michigan Hot Rod Association, kept. Mm-hmm. And they still own it today. 25% of that show.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the ones that set it up. They're the ones that pick the top eight.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones that do everything.
Yep.
That little association. There's only about six guys now that have any power whatsoever. So there's six guys picking America for non-American most beautiful.
The Riddler.
The Riddler.
Yeah.
Six guys pick that, not judges. Same six guys every year.
Yeah.
And they're terrible prejudices. They like what they like and they pick what they like.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that's probably not well.
But you've done the same at your show. You've picked what you liked.
Fine nine.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Well, I don't, but. Yeah,
yeah.
I make the final decision on the big one, of course. Or I did. I don't anymore. Cliff showed it.
Yeah.
And the judges. But anyway, answer your question, the first show he ever did was in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And I was already doing a car show in Wichita. And that he actually ran himself, or owned himself, I should say. He ran them for a lot of years because he's president of the association for them. So, but he featured me as a feature car with the predicted first one. And so from then on, he started working with Bill Cushenberry. He had Bill cars. Bill built the dream car, numerous cars for Larry. And then two or three guys in California, Chuck Miller and some of the other guys, began building cars for Larry and his car shows. Well, in the meantime, I had my own car shows. You know, I was running them. I was up to 12 car shows. But some of those, then they talked me into joining the ISCA. And they did it through threats. They sent a guy named, maybe I shouldn't say it. Anyway, they sent a guy they hired in to do car shows ahead of me.
In the same town?
1 week in the same town. Huh. Oklahoma City was the first one they did it. They actually paid this guy to come in and do a show ahead of me to kill me.
Yeah.
Well, rather than fighting them, I joined them.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't afford not to.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want a lot. You know, I just had to pay my fee like everybody. And, but you paid by fours. You know, there are four categories in ISCA.
Yeah.
And I had to pay the most money because I had the most shows besides their shows. They had maybe 75 shows at that time. And I had 10, maybe.
So at that time, ISCA was doing 75 shows a year.
Yeah.
Yeah. People forget how many. I mean, that was before there was Street Machine Nationals. It was before Good Guys. It was before NSRA. Oh, yeah. So ISCA was like it, man. They were everywhere. Oh, small towns, big towns, coliseums, little fairgrounds buildings. Peoria, the one I went to when I was little, it wasn't a very big building.
And when I started to do more shows, which I got up to 15, they would come to me and say, well, we already got a franchise on that. See, then at that point when I joined them, I had to franchise my shows. Well, to get another show, some producer could pay the fee on that and get a franchise on it and maybe not even produce it. Carl Casper did numerous ones. Bill Holtz, remember him?
Yeah, kind of.
Oh, he did the same thing. About every show that was any size or town, they've claimed they had a franchise on it. So like when I went into Albuquerque, good example, Carl Casper steps up and says, I own a franchise on Albuquerque, you can't do it. And I said, well, why haven't you done a show? And he says, I got one plan. So rather than lose it, town, which I'd already spent time putting it together, I took him in as a half partner, or 25% partner, and just mafia, I mean, power, you know what I'm saying?
Connections,
you know. And so anyway, he was my partner for years. When I sold it or gave it up, he took it over. And they ran a show there for a couple of years, bombed. Yeah. So it didn't have a show, and then the guy has it now, or did have it, took it over. It was, he was my judge at the time.
Yeah.
Judged my show. And he run cars in my show.
Yeah.
Himself.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's a long story.
So how many years were you... And you worked your way up pretty high in ISCA too, didn't you?
Well, I actually took it over.
Okay.
I actually ran it for 3 years.
Okay.
And I turned it from 170 shows to 225 shows.
In 1 year?
In 1 year.
There was 200, over 200 shows. Because I know sometimes you said that you were someplace. Donna was in another town because you were running an indoor show for ISCA franchised. That's just mind blowing to me. As many shows as I do, my wife's sitting here. She works for a company that runs 6 or 7 events for one group and 3 for another and 3 for another. But to have one organization, ISCA at that time, and what year was this? They were doing over 200 shows in 1 year.
I had the show or had ISCA for
70s and 80s.
I started it 32 years ago.
Oh, 90s.
When I started yeah, it's in the 90s.
Okay.
92 maybe. And I ran it to 96, something like that. 92 for 3 years.
And now they have a dozen shows on their circuit now, as all the ISCA sanctioned shows have.
When I dropped out, about 25 of the producers dropped out at the same time.
Yeah.
Small producers.
But that's about the time of the era when NSRA was getting a big stronghold and doing big events outdoors, and then Good Guys came along and
it really wiped us out.
Power Tour started in the mid-90s, and a lot of people seen that, oh, you can make money putting on events. So now there's
several.
You can't even count how many event companies there are running tuner events and drift events and drag racing and show cars and indoor, outdoor, you know, off-road stuff. It's a big business. I mean, it always has been a big business to car people, but it's definitely is.
I dropped from 15 to 2, 3, and then I eventually sold 2 of those.
Yeah, somebody still runs the Wichita show. There's not one in Oklahoma City anymore, right?
No, I dropped it out.
Yeah.
They tried to run one there.
Yeah.
But
I know the guys that are doing Wichita, and it's a pretty good event they do down there, kind of a charity event. So here we are. We're going to try to wrap this up. We've been talking for a while, and we could talk all day long about your cars and everything. There's a few things I would like to touch on. One, still going back to the car show stuff, we talked about this last night, that you and Donna, when I see all these pictures, it was a whole different generation of people. You guys dressed to the nines. She was in dresses and her hair was done while you guys were judging, and then you wore, I always knew about the leather jackets. I didn't know you had leather pants until this morning or last night we were talking about that. But yeah, I've heard stories that you would go into these towns and go to certain places, like maybe you got a jacket, same guy that did Elvis's outfits or something like that, don't you? Absolutely. And you wore these leather jackets for the awards and stuff, and you guys always, it's something they just don't do anymore. Every once in a while you go to a thing at SEMA and somebody's wearing a tux or something like that. But I just thought that era was just really cool on how you guys presented yourselves in front of people for the events. I mean, this is normal to us because we're car people. But people that aren't car people, we're just weird people. You do all this stuff in cars, and you go to car shows and all that stuff, and some of our family don't understand it. But I just thought that era of you guys just dressed up, it just was, the pictures were just really cool. So it was just to make it look cool, or what was the whole thought process, or just snappy dressers?
Well, I'm going to tell you a little story real quick. Like I always got stories to tell. I always felt, and I still feel the same way, that any celebrity of any type, and I'm not saying I was ever a celebrity, but whatever I was, has a responsibility to set an example for younger people, you know, and have an image that they could look up to. Because everything that's wrong with sports today or wrong with business today, period, is nobody has any heroes anymore. Hardly.
Yeah.
One or two is each category. But like and I always use the Beatles as a prime example. They had a responsibility to the country, to the world, and they become what they were.
Mm-hmm.
They set the worst possible, in my opinion of our people that they could ever be of, because they did whatever they wanted, whenever they wanted, and it always benefited them the most. They could care what everybody else thought.
Yeah.
You know, they were the gods, so to speak. And they acted like gods instead of like people.
Yeah, they were the first, kind of like what you say, quote, rock star mentality.
And so to me, to have to be meet their maker, they had some real explanation to do, because they when you get right down to it, God's the one that makes you what you are. And if you don't respect that, in dress and appearance and talking and setting examples. I feel you're not doing the proper thing.
Which we're not dressed up right now. We're just recording. We're not doing video, but we're not dressed up right now. Right. You should have put on a leather jacket just for the interview.
No. I'm not that vain, but I am very vain. And I'm not saying I'm perfect by any means, but I do try very hard, and I have over the years of setting examples for everybody, a little above everybody, because I felt that was a responsibility of anybody that had that position to do that.
But you also come up from the era that hot rod guys were just hoodlums and street racers and all that stuff. You were in that, like we see in the old black and white movies and stuff like that. Exactly. Not to bring up the age factor or anything, but so you kind of worked hard to bring the car light to a positive note when you went into these towns, instead of being, oh, what are these hoodlums renting our convention center for?
Exactly right.
So you kind of, now it's kind of, car people are kind of known, and yes, there is a certain circle of them that aren't doing good things now in the car world, but you kind of had to do that. So you made yourself look better in front of people to make you guys get a little bit better known. It's like, oh, the hot rodders come to the convention center, and they were very well dressed, and they, you know, it was a nice event. So,
and now it's pretty respectful group that come, really.
Yeah.
When you really get down to it, now, they don't wear leather suits by any means.
Yeah.
But they do come a little better looking than most people come.
Maybe, Carrie, we should bring back the leather suits. Yeah. We're trying to, we're 80s kids, 70s, 80s, so we're trying to bring back satin jackets. We have satin jackets that we didn't bring them this weekend. Yeah, so.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
And you should do something on your own, but yet something that's a little above everybody else, because you are a little above whether you ought to be or not.
So
and you should set an example.
So let's talk a little bit on the outside of the car world of things you did through your life, which I didn't know until I read your book. You had a Rubens sandwich shop. How many of those? This was before Subway. This was what years was this? 80s?
This was in
90s. I don't know if it said in that book.
It'd be in the 80s.
This was before the normal sub shop that you would go in, and you kind of had more than one, didn't you? Like almost like a small franchise, or you were trying to do that?
That's what I set the whole thing up as a franchise. I put a name to it, put Rubens' statue there. Mm-hmm. He was a special little guy. I was going to make it a chain of events. Was my plan. And I built a building to match the whole thing out of an old filling station. I added the whole thing and changed the whole thing. Good location right on the highway, Highway 54, right close to downtown. And it was doing real well. I had it for 3 years. And I was ready to break. I'd already signed or in the process of signing papers to do the next one up the road a little ways on the same highway.
Mm-hmm.
And about that same time, they decided to widen the highway.
Mm-hmm.
54 Highway, which is the main highway through Wichita, not Highway 54. Well, 54 blocked my entryway into my sandwich shop. So all at once, you couldn't come into my sandwich shop off of the highway. They took the exit off, period. And let you exit off. You had to exit off almost two blocks down the street, turn around and come back up the side street to my shop. This cut my business in a third just overnight.
Wow.
When they even announced the fact they were widening, let alone getting the widening.
Yeah.
It took them about 2 years to widen the dumb thing. Well, in the meantime, I had to close it up. And when I closed it up, I didn't lose a lot of money, but I lost all that business that I put into it all that time. And it killed my idea. I canceled the other contract right away because on the same highway, only about the other in the town.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have done the same thing to it if I'd have built.
Yeah. So you could have been the start of Subway. It could have been Rubens instead of Subway.
And I got my idea really out of California because they have out there the Hofbräus in Oakland and in San Francisco. And they're still going. They're doing great. Mm-hmm. Hofbräus is probably the most famous fast food restaurant in the world, much so than any of here in that town.
Yeah.
Everybody goes to California, San Francisco's got to go to Hofbräu. And it's,
I'll have to do that the next time. I haven't done that before.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, you got to go to Hofbräu. And
so then you're always a, you guys are always a fan of entertainment, live music, all that stuff. You guys have just love that type of stuff. Oh, yeah. So you also ran an Edgewater Villa Resort. Was that over in Branson?
That was in Eureka Springs, which is a suburb of Branson. And Eureka Springs is a tourist town also. And I went over there and leased a theater, or leased a piece of ground to put my, I first did Christmas Expo before.
That was the Dickens one?
Dickens, yeah.
Okay.
I did it first, and I moved it over into Branson when I gave it up to Christmas Expo, and because it was also a tourist town, and I put a Christmas show or a Christmas village in Eureka Springs, and I set up.
And that was a seasonal around the holidays?
Yeah.
So I grew up on a Christmas tree farm, so I understand the seasonal Christmas business stuff.
Well, it wasn't really seasonal because it's summertime.
Oh, okay.
I had the Christmas stuff during the summer, selling Christmas gifts and all that stuff. Crafts, so, but right beside it, I also put a little museum, which had 12 cars in it, a car museum. And I had 12 of my cars in it. Right beside it. So you had two places to go. You could come to the Christmas show, the Christmas Expo, or you could come to the Daryl Starwood car show. And it was called Starwood Expo or something. Can't even think what I called it. But anyway, there's a regular country theater right beside all this. Well, the people that ran it decided they didn't want to run it no more. Because there's two country or three country theaters in that little town or that village. And so the owner of the building come to me and says, would you like to lease the theater? Because I need to lease it out. And I never ran a theater. I said, sure, give it to me. I started paying him the lease money on it. I put my own show together. And that's when I first got into really all-out show business, you know? And I call it Elvis Country Theater. And I had an Elvis impersonator, Jim Burleson, as a second act, and I had a regular Ozark show, the first half of it, an hour, 2 hour show. And I had it for 5 years, I guess. And it did well, but it also, the country thing went from boom to here just almost overnight because Branson just way overbuilt. I mean, it had country theaters everywhere, dozens of them, but most of them are gone. Well, mine, when I quit it, it went away too because they built a bank right on top of the building. The guy owned the ground. Sold it to a bank, that theater. They tore the theater down and built a bank there now. And I gave the thing back to him, or quit leasing it from him, and sold all my equipment off to the Passion Play, which is up on the hill, which is the story of Christ, you know. And they were going to do a Christmas show. And they were going to use all my props and stuff in that Christmas show. Well, I had built two-story buildings for craftspeople to be in when I was in the Christmas Expo and a lot of Christmas stuff, period. They bought all that stuff. And then the next thing I know, all the buildings I built, which is for the Christmas Expo, were I built 30 buildings for each town. I did three cities at the same time, Oklahoma City, Wichita.
Oh, wow.
Tulsa.
Yeah.
And I go down there a few weeks after they bought it, and they got back behind the theater where I was at. They'd taken all the fronts that I built out of wood and sort of in the creek behind it, and they're all on fire. Burned every one of them.
So how many years did you do that?
Five.
Okay. And was that the only place that you had in, did you have another place in Branson too, another entertainment place, or just that one?
That was the only one I had in Branson.
Okay.
But also I had the...
And then you had one in San Antonio. Headwater.
Then I moved to San Antonio. Well, I actually moved it to... the next place I did was... San Antonio. I built the Elvis Country Theater in San Antonio. When I built or sold a Roadster show,
mm-hmm.
I took that money and put it in San Antonio on the Riverwalk, which is real famous.
Yeah, we were there this summer. Very neat place, yeah.
And I spent a lot of money on it. And
about killed yourself, too, the story I heard last night. You fell during tearing out a concrete stairway, and yeah.
I took a one-story drop on my rear.
Yeah.
It about killed me, actually. Probably should have. No.
You've had a lot of those death experiences.
But anyway, that was kind of my entertainment in that field, the Elvis Country Theater. And
how long was the San Antonio place going?
It lasted maybe four.
Okay.
4 years, probably.
So between the Branson area place, the Eureka Springs, you were in the entertainment stuff for about 10 years. So, and didn't you have like some decent, I mean, I'm not a big country music person. We've talked about this, but didn't like the Mandrell sisters sing at one of your places one time, or is that a different something? That,
what's this? Show?
The Barbara Mandrell. I mean, didn't you have like names like that come through your club or not?
Oh, Barbara Mandrell I never did have.
Okay.
I owned equipment that they use for Barbara Mandrell.
Oh, that was it.
In okay. Branson.
Okay. You know, I'm going to say, we've spent a lot of time working in the noisy shop and in the museum out here, that a lot of the stories are pretty awesome. So
I also use it in all my car shows. Personalities, you know.
Yeah, like wrestlers, we should touch on that real quick. You had from Playboy Playmates and the Bikini Girls, and it was a big thing. ISCA was a big thing of people to get people that were just casual car people, but they wanted to come and see Hulk Hogan or somebody like that. So you had a lot of the celebrities. And who's like the coolest person, a celebrity that you dealt with, and maybe who was the one of the worst?
Well, that kind of depends on whether you're talking about a celebrity that made an appearance or a celebrity that performed. We had both.
Okay. Give us one of each.
Performer-wise, the most famous would have been Roy Orbison.
Okay.
Ricky Nelson.
Mm-hmm.
Which
his boys live close to me, and they're, one of them's a hot rod guy. I've been to his house looking at a hot rod for him.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Ricky Nelson's kids were... They got into like heavy metal music in the 80s.
Oh, okay.
The twin, his two twins.
I used about every 50 star you can think of in my shows and theater. My theater, I did matinees down there, and I used all name stars
mm-hmm.
down there as well as in my car show.
Mm-hmm.
So about everybody you can think of, it was in the 50s or 60s. I've used probably dozens of them.
Well, this weekend we got Candy Clark coming that was in American Graffiti, and we just touched on that. They actually, Toad says your name in the American Graffiti movie, and there was no, what was he say?
Said Gerald Strawberry.
Superfleck Moonbeam, but there was no, that was a made-up car name. You never made a Superfleck Moonbeam car, did you?
No, I didn't, but he was referring, I met Lucas, who did that movie, that was his first movie, and I met him in San Francisco. And he asked me if he could use his name. And I said, I didn't know who he was. I thought he's some local joke.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he turns out to be the biggest producer ever in the world.
But, and that car's cult-like status, and we're still talking about it to this day. And
right. At the time, I thought it was a B-movie that probably nobody had ever watched.
Yeah.
So I said, sure, use it. And so he asked me to kind of give him advice on how to do it exactly, because he loved my cars. He loved futuristic stuff, which he did Star Wars, all their movies. But that's what inspired him to use my car. The fact that in high school, my car is what he loved. mobile top cars, futuristic cars. And so anyway, that's how I got to Joe Lucas. And but the funny part about it, I've never been able to talk to the guy for years. I mean, he wouldn't even answer my calls.
Yeah.
But nobody would let him answer in Detroit.
Yeah.
The same deal happened to me on what's her name? She's a big star right now.
Carrie Underwood.
Carrie Underwood.
She sang at your
same way.
At one of your car shows, didn't she? Yeah,
she started my car show.
Yeah.
She started my show and Jerry Titus.
So she sang at the Tulsa show and she sang at the Lead Sled Spectacular as she was making a name for herself.
Right. Yeah. And she also sang right outside there on at our annual deal on the lake.
Oh, really?
Hall of Fame.
Oh, wow.
Down
on the right lake. Here on the property.
Yeah, right here, right down on the lake.
Yeah.
She sang there for 2 years in a row. And her group still sang there for several years after she left.
Yeah.
So anyway, they didn't allow her to do anything else.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't even talk to her the first 2 years.
Yeah.
Because she was screened. Nobody could talk to her.
Yeah.
What's his name? The producer, what's his name? Anyway, don't matter. Put a restriction on anybody on the.
She was probably pretty young when she sang for you guys, wasn't she?
14.
14. Carrie Underwood sang for you guys.
Yeah. And
that's pretty awesome.
About 3 hours.
And I'm not a country music person, but I know who she is. So.
Yeah, but she's big. She's done a lot and still does a lot.
Yep. Yep.
She's probably the most popular of the baby who.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of anybody.
So let's try to wrap this up. I got one other story I want to see if you'll tell, and then we're going to talk about where the museum and the Hall of Fame come from to wrap it up.
Okay.
So there's one story you told me of doing stuff. If you don't want to talk about this, it's fine, but doing stuff in between events when you're out on the road. The story that I always laugh about is you told me a story about cactuses.
Oh.
That just cracks me up, of the things that you would do in between events. Either make money or to kill the time. Tell us an abbreviated version of the cactus story.
Okay. First of all, I'm going to tell you one more quick story.
Okay.
So I'm talking about things doing in between. I always did that because I always had an employee that had nothing to do in the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very good people on the road selling commercial space. For instance, Joan's husband worked for me for several years. Because he's super on the road, I mean, selling stuff. But I didn't have nothing for him to do in the summertime because he didn't build cars.
Mm-hmm.
I bought that resort for her and him to have something to do during the summertime.
Yeah.
That's how I started that resort.
Okay.
And I lasted 18 years with it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it went from a very small investment to a very large investment because that whole thing caught on fire. I mean, fire become a big deal. Branson did all at once after I bought that place.
Yeah.
So I got 10 times as much for it as I paid for it.
So that Edgewater place?
That's Edgewater.
Had that for 18 years?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And I made that much money on it. It went from nothing or nothing. $100,000, I think, to whatever it sold for. Anyway. I want to tell that quick story because that kind of got into what you're talking about. I also, one summer, didn't have anything to do, and I had this guy working for me called John Davis. And John was a good friend, as well as I'd built him a car. And he worked for me selling Dickens Christmas Expo. So sold the commercial space. Mm-hmm. So we didn't have nothing to do that summer for him to do. So I'd always done the El Paso show and for 20 years or so. And every time I'd go by all them cactus, yucca trees, they're called, I'd say, God, all them things out in this field here, and them thing at home would be worth $50 a piece. Every one of them, God, there's $1 billion sitting out here. I went by that thing for 10 years thinking that very thing. So anyway, finally got up to where we did nothing to do that summer, and I made a lot of money. So I went, I had him go to Walmart. No, not Walmart.
It was a hardware store or something, wasn't it?
No, it was one of the chains.
Ace Hardware?
No.
Yeah, there wasn't Walmart everywhere back then. Anyway, it went to a place.
Well, anyway, I went there, or he did, and he sold them 500 trees for a big sale. 500 yuccas.
Because he could sell anything. So he sold these trees that you didn't have, these cactus trees.
I didn't have them. I had no idea how to get them. I just knew they were down there. And he actually sold them, 500 of them, at a certain price. But we had it happen delivered in 30 days because it's a big sale before Christmas. Mm-hmm. So we go down there with my semi-truck, empty.
The one that used to haul cars into all the shows, big stacker semi.
And it had a big long cable on it to pull cars in and out. Well, I get down there and we take two shovels. We pull up to this place where I saw all these trees out in this field, no fence around it, on the highway. And I says, boy, looky there, there's a paradise. So we get out of the truck and park it off the side as far as I could get it. And we go out there and we start digging. We're out there digging up this yucca tree. And a highway patrolman pulls up behind the truck. And he looks out there. We're out there digging his tree up. He gets out of his car, two of them actually, come back and say, what are you guys doing? He says, well, we're digging up some yuccas. We want to take some nice yuccas. He says, those are government property. You can't take them off of there. It's against the law. You cannot pull trees, yucca trees, off of the government property. And he says, but you guys seem like decent people, and it looks like you've got a lot of time. And fast, I told him who I was and what I did. And he knew who I was because he'd been to my car show, fortunately, which I did El Paso 40 years. Anyway. He says, but down the road here, about 4 miles or five, there's a farmer that owns, not government property, but it's got hundreds of yucca trees on it. He might even pay to take them off because he likes to clear it. Mm-hmm. Well, so I drive down there, pull in the driveway. About 25 kids come running out. Not that many, but a lot of little kids. And this is a little old tiny place up on a hill. And yuccas everywhere, as far as I could see. I could drive in that driveway, and this little old man comes out. Only not little, he's about your age. And he comes out, and he says, well, what can I do for you guys? He says, you got trouble on the highway? I said, no, I got trouble here. I want some of your yucca trees. He says, you want some of them? I said, yeah, I'm going to pull them off and take them. He says, well, hey, that's great. I said, what would you take for them? It's $1 a tree. I said, $1 a tree? I'll take all I can pull. He says, pull them all out of there. I don't care. But I want $1 for every tree. So like dummies, we start. We got no idea how to get the trees out of the ground except with two shovels. I go out there and it takes us almost a whole day to dig up one tree. I says, got over here 5 years each of. And besides the two of us, we're dying. We're out here in the desert and with clothes on that we shouldn't have on. And you don't think deserts have anybody on them or anything. They got millions of little animals, millions of bugs, millions of snakes.
Yeah.
Everything you could dream of is in the deserts. Alive. Mm-hmm. I never thought there was anything alive on. So we get out there. And it took us that long to get the first tree. I said, we got to do something different or this ain't going to work. So I headed into a town with him. And we went to the first nursery, saw the head yuckers for sale. And I said, what do you guys get for them? You know, and they said $30, $40, $50 a tree, depending on the size of them. And I said, well, how in the world could you dig them up? how do you get them out of the ground? Because that ground's hard to rock. And he said, oh, we don't dig them up. I said, you don't? And he says, no, we just take a chain, hook them onto the bottom of the trunk, and just pull away with the tractor, and it yanks them out of the ground. And they break off down about 6 foot. When it comes up, the root does. Because the root goes down 20 feet.
Jeez.
As tall as it is hard, the root does. But when you break it off, it doesn't affect the growth of them. You just stick it back in the ground, the dumb thing grow right back up. So we loaded and we started digging them up and got our arms swelled up. We'd pick them up and the little cactus get in your arms. Our stomach broke up because it was holding on our stomachs. We were in such bad shape within a week that it looked like we were sick in bed than we should have been. 6 weeks we pulled trees. 6 weeks. In 6 weeks we pulled 32 trees. Working 12 to 15.
Only 32 trees?
32 trees out of 100. And we only got a week deadline until we got to have them in Wichita.
You're supposed to have 500 of them?
No, 100
of them. 100 of them, okay.
So, there's one big one right in the middle of all this. It's really tall. And I wanted it around my swimming pool. You know, I had it at home.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I was going to keep 30 of them around my fence and plant them, you know.
After going through all that, I would have never want to see one again. I wouldn't want one on my property.
Well, I probably didn't after that. But anyway, we went back there, and we actually sold 30 of them to the store.
Mm-hmm.
And they sold them on the big sale, and they were happy. But they were unhappy because they wanted 100, and they spent money advertising. The fact they had all these yuccas for sale. Well, to make the story really bad, every one of them yuccas died the first couple of years because we had a terrible cold winter. We never have, you know, at that time. They live through the winter normally, but not when it gets below about 30.
Yeah.
They do die. And my great big one, I planted out by my tree, or by my swimming pool. That thing even died within 5 years. We had to pull it up, but we did. I mean, we made money on it, but I'll guarantee you, I wouldn't go back and do this again for $1 million. $1 million, probably. I never had such a miserable 6 weeks in my life. And to tell the whole story to him, the very last day we were leaving, the little old lady, which she's a very nice person, very nice. I say the old lady, she was about your age. But she looked like she was twice your age. And she come up to me and she says, Daryl, I want to cook you supper tonight. When you guys come off the field, I want you to come in. I'm going to have you a feast. I said, oh, really? That sounds great.
She cooked cactus for you, didn't she?
Anyway, we come in and we were dirty. I mean, we were dirty, you know, for being out in the field.
Mm-hmm.
She says, we'll go in there and clean up before you eat. We go in there and there's this tub about this big around, a horse tug, you know, those metal, full of dirt water, dirty water. She says, you can take your bath in that, clean up. We've been doing it for weeks. Everybody takes a bath.
It's the same water.
Because they haul all the water in once a week
with
a truck with a tank on the back of it because it didn't have no well.
Yeah.
So anyway, John, I walk in that bathroom and it gets so dirty looking. I didn't even want to put my finger in the water. But anyway, we had to at least splash off, you know, to get the dirt off the face. And we sat down and we ate, and her face feast, and it was good, actually good food, but it was all Mexican food, and I don't like Mexican food. I mean, you know, not normal Mexican food, but true Mexican food, you know. But I ate it. I didn't like it, but I ate it. Johnny didn't mind it. But anyway, she was being very, very cordial and very proud of everything, and she had I'm not kidding you, she had 12 kids, 12 of them, and they all lived in that little old house, and they all had most of the time I saw them that were either completely nude or had some clothes on because it's hot, you know. I couldn't believe it. But they turned out to be probably the nicest people we'll ever meet.
Yeah.
And the kids the same way. They're very curious, very nice. Loved us guys like
we They just thought you were crazy people out there digging them. They tell stories about these crazy people from up north that come down to buy their cactuses. I'm sure they're telling stories to this day.
So anyway, that's the story.
Okay, so we got one more story here.
Okay.
The Robin Custom Car Hall of Fame Museum and the Hall of Fame that you started.
Okay.
You went out to a museum in California.
I went to Peterson Museum, Car Museum, which is the one that Peterson put together. And when Peterson put the Car Museum together, George Burris gave him every piece of equipment to put in a makeup shop, showing how we built cars, you know. And George donated every bit of that. They built that whole thing around George Burris. Never had his name on it anywhere. That's the first thing I noticed. God, George didn't even get credit for any of this stuff. And they used all his stuff. Second, I walk over and I realize suddenly there isn't a car in here, period, that I built, period. And there's no cars in here that several of us built that should have been. It turned out to be Peterson, which we made all his money on Hot Rod Custom. Mm-hmm. You know, he branched off into all the other magazines. But they actually made their money on the cars that we built. I wrote many stories for him. I used to sit in his office, used to give me an office every time I'd go there. George Burris had a permanent office right in his building, you know, Peterson.
Mm-hmm.
And Peterson did every magazine there was, car magazine, except Tom Olligan started up Street Rodder and that group, you know, Custom Rodder and all those magazines. And that's where Tom Vogley comes in. Tom actually worked for
McMullen, didn't he?
McMullen,
yeah.
And McMullen, immediately took a like me because he actually started his first. He came to Oakland first when I owned it, and he put in a. He started out motorcycles, and he put in a motorcycle display in my Oakland show, and from that he branched into the Street Rodder. Then he bought the booth for Street Rodder. That's where I met Tom first, because he up there come up there and run that booth for him, and. So that's how I got into the Hall of Fame deal. I walked into that place and I said, we made him all his money, George and I did, or we did a lot of it, let's put it that way. And the guy don't even mention either one of us in the Hold On Museum. I said, boy, that's terrible. They're not just him and I made this thing happen, but a lot of guys did. None of them's got any credit in here for it. It's all about other cars. He actually did more about, he made a transportation event, really. The museum. I mean, he built a 50s looking city right inside of it. And all of his displays were built more around
just Americana type of thing. Americana, yeah. Amazing museum, though. Great.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's a nice museum. Yeah. Don't misunderstand me. He had a lot of money to spend.
Yeah.
Well, he bankrupted the thing the first 5 years. He gave it to the city, or the city took it over. Well, then he turns around and buys it back from the city because they couldn't make it work for 3 years. He paid a dime on the dollar for what he sold it to him for. A dime on the dollar. He got the whole thing back. He then did a lot more work. He did, at that point, begin bringing in custom cars and hot rods. But he put them in the basement to start with. The whole basement was all of our cars, the bigger cars. Then he finally built it upstairs, put a third floor on it, and opened it up to more custom rods. It never has been what I call a real true car museum. But anyway, I went home and I said, I'm going to build a museum. And it's going to have credit to everybody in this business, not just me. And I'm going to highlight the thing as Hall of Fame, and I'm going to bring in everybody that built cars that I feel deserves to be in it. And I brought in 10 guys first, the top 10.
Mm-hmm.
And I built the building, and I spent all my money on it. I paid for everything as I went, never borrowed a penny. And I took it all out of my business. You know. And I put everybody's name in there. I could over the years. We did two or three guys every year for mm-hmm. the next 32 years.
Yeah, now there's builders, there's journalists, there's collectors, there's lifetime achievement, there's designers. So,
Everybody got credit.
So what year was that? When did you start the museum and the Hall of Fame? Mid-90s?
92.
Okay.
92.
So basically because you went to the Peterson and they didn't have a Hall of Fame and didn't have enough credit for the customizers and hot rod builders, you came back out here and end up being, it was what, 20,000 square foot museum?
Yeah, it was 20. Well, originally it was only half of the 10,000 square foot.
Mm-hmm.
Then I built two more wings onto it and then a gift shop.
And ran that for many years here, and Hall of Fame inductions, which I'm honored to be in there, and had a couple cars on display. And now that is moved to
Lincoln, Nebraska.
Yeah, people call it the Speedway Museum, but it's called the Museum of Speed. And they're building a new building that I know is going to be done this year. And they have your cars on display up there. So everything that we're on the property here by the house, there's nothing in the museum now, but it's still continuing. And I think it's a great place that the Speedway guys have that at their museum, and a lot of people will see it up there in Lincoln.
Yes,
of course, here you were not far off Route 66, and some people, well, why was that museum there? Well, you lived here and you had the property, and in the summertime, this place is a vacation mecca. Here off Monkey Island and the Big Grand Lake is outside of Tulsa, not say just south of Route 66.
I don't want anybody to ever think that it wasn't successful, because it was very successful and very attended event. My whole plan was to build something to remember everybody, and that's what it was supposed to be, to glorify the whole hot rod custom car world.
Yeah, which I think you guys did that with your sidekick, Donna, was very instrumental in running that place. Absolutely. And that's when she passed, that was kind of you were already in talks with Speedway, and that kind of sped things up, because she was the lady that greeted everybody and sold all the t-shirts and the trinkets. And she was always excited. Oh, I got coffee cups now. Look at this. Or I got shot glasses. Whenever you came, she was excited about the new thing to sell in the gift shop. So
her life for 30 years.
Yeah.
We're 100% that museum. I couldn't even get the woman to take a vacation. We never had a vacation but twice in 32 years.
She's still mad because you didn't win that trip to Paris back in the day.
Well, that's probably right. Probably torture. But anyway,
So I think we've talked about enough today. So again, the Hall of Fame Museum and the Rod and Custom Car Hall of Fame is still going on. It's going to be up at the Museum of Speed in Lincoln. So you are, how old are you now? How young are you?
How old am I?
Yeah, you're 89. 89 years old. Have done all this stuff that we didn't even, a tip of the iceberg of the stuff that you've done in your career in the automotive world and not in the automotive world. And you're sitting here, he talked about being a designer and an architect at Boeing, and we're sitting here in his dining room with an architect table, sitting right here working on his new plans. And in his office, he has an architect table out there. He's always got a drawing table. So as everybody in the hot rod industry and me honored to be in your Hall of Fame, I want to thank you for everything you've done for all of us. Looked up to you as a kid, read about you in the magazines. You inspired many generations. I built some of your model cars. I learned multiplication a little bit and division because I wanted to build your model car. So I want to thank you for your time today. We talked, you thought this was going to be like a half hour interview, and I think we talked for almost 3 hours now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and we still haven't talked again about everything. So I want to thank you very much, Mr. Dale Starbun, and I'm honored to be your friend, and thanks for your time today.
Well, you know what? Without guys like you, we would have been, or I would have been nothing.
Yeah.
So I want to thank you guys, and you especially, because you've become a close friend, and I admire what you've done, and you keep doing, and you're doing it right now by keeping this whole thing going,
mm-hmm.
which is very important. Probably the most important thing is to keep this thing alive.
Yeah, I agree. That's why we want to start this podcast, to get, we're going to try to get some guys this weekend at the show in Tulsa and get Jerry Titus and Jack Walker and some of these guys to talk. And so I've been honored to stay here many times. I've helped you in your shop. I've even trimmed bushes for you the last time I was here.
Did I ever dig ditches?
I didn't dig a ditch, but I've helped you fix your lawnmower, help you buy groceries. I even cooked you breakfast this morning. So.
Oh, yeah, you did. Yeah, hey, so, by the way, that was a good breakfast.
It was good. So again, thank you for your time, and thanks for everything you've done.
Well, thank you.
So that was a part three, the last section of the interview that we have. We had almost 3 hours with Daryl Starbird sitting at his house. It was awesome to sit down with him. Carrie was there with us. You didn't talk a whole lot on this one, did you?
I didn't have a chance. You guys were just...
This is actually one of our... I think it was our first ever recording. It was doing Daryl.
Well, no, I think it was the second. We did your dad first, which we haven't aired his yet.
Okay, but we're still figuring out the sound levels and we're still learning. But just we just love to get the sound and the stories out from these legends. And our next week's, or last week's guest was Chris Ryan. Mm-hmm. And me and Chris talk about that a lot. If it wasn't for guys like Daryl Starbird, Gene Winfield, Bill Hines, all those guys, we wouldn't be doing what we're doing for a living. They definitely made the path for us to continue today and continue on in the future. And next week, we have, I'm going to call him a modern custom car building legend. Absolutely. Newly inducted this year in the Rod and Custom Car Hall of Fame, Rob Ida, coming to you from New Jersey.
I'm looking forward. We're actually going to record that tomorrow night, and I'm really looking forward to this interview. I think everybody's going to like it, so make sure you tune in. Like Axel said, make sure you tune in and hear what Rob Ida has to say.
And these cat sounds are not edited, people. The cats are in here, and our young kitten Axel is very vocal, so sometimes he makes his appearance known.
And he's just sitting there talking. I hope somebody understands it, and maybe your cats are relating to it. And all right, well, we will talk to you soon.